This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good evening, everybody. This crowd is like the exhibition has been since we opened it, very full in this space. It's great to see you all here tonight. Thank you for joining us. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Matthew Trinker. I'm the director of the National Museum of Australia, and I'd like to start, as we always do here at the National Museum, by acknowledging that we meet tonight on the traditional lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, the traditional owners of this land, and I'd like to offer my respect to their elders past and present. And I'd like to extend that to all Indigenous Australians who might be joining us tonight in this crowd. It's great to see you all here this evening for what promises to be an enlightening and we hope entertaining as well. I think museums are allowed to be entertaining. A discussion themed around our current exhibition, A History of the World in 100 Objects from the British Museum. And I'm pleased to say that ABC Radio National has been our absolutely perfect media partner for this exhibition. And tonight's event is being expertly led by our host, ABC RN's breakfast presenter, Fran Kelly, who's just to my left. And you might remember, I think, that it was even discussed this morning on RN that the station ran a great competition recently based on people telling stories about their own special objects and how they had formed or been formed by events surrounding those objects. Tonight's panel will explore what objects from the past reveal about the people who made them. They'll also touch on the role of museums in collecting and exhibiting them. And then we might ask them as well to reflect on a question that you might find interesting to think about too, and that is, if you could rewrite history, what, if anything, would you change? So think about that. You might have a few views on this at the end, but there'll be some opportunity for questions. I'd like now to welcome our panellists. On Fran's left is Belinda Creer, the British Museum's exhibition curator for A History of the World in 100 Objects. And welcome back, Belinda. It's great to have you with us again. And to her left is academic and author Clive Hamilton. Many thanks to Clive, not least for making himself available at short notice tonight after Tim Flannery was unfortunately forced to withdraw. And some of you will know that Clive is a professor of public ethics at Charles Sturt University in Canberra, and his books include Requiem for a Species, Why We Resist the Truth About Climate Change, I wonder why, and Earth Masters Playing God with the Climate. To Clive's left is author, I'm looking to check that I get this order right, not because I'm uncertain, author Delia Falconer, who is a celebrated writer of two novels, The Service of Clouds and The Last Thoughts of Soldiers, and a really lovely book, a personal history of her hometown of Sydney, which I love. And to her left is journalist and author Gideon Haig. Recent titles by Gideon include The Deserted Newsroom, End of the Road on Australia's Car Industry, and Ashes to Ashes, published just a couple of years ago. And of course, welcome to Fran Kelly, who joins us for her first National Museum panel discussion. Welcome, Fran, it's great to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
She's a highly respected radio presenter who's also very well known as a challenging current affairs journalist, political correspondent, and foreign correspondent. And I'm now delighted to hand over to Fran to kick off tonight's proceedings. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Matt. And before I go any further, it's not often I get to come face to face with the audience because it's always through the radio. So I just thought I'd put a shout out to see, did any of you enter the competition? Put your hand, yeah, see, I knew there'd be at least one. We got 1,500 entries, which is phenomenal. And I think just sort of goes to how much this exhibition captures the imagination. I mean, really such a preposterous idea to try and track humankind's cultural, social and political evolution, an evolution steered by our own hand and minds across centuries, civilizations and religions through just 100 man-made objects. Preposterous, and as it turns out, incredibly wonderful, which I'm sure if you've seen it, you'd agree. As I roamed through this exhibition from treasure to treasure, I was really struck by the repeated patterns and consistencies and individual civilizations across the centuries developing their tools, their icons, their aesthetic, and then critically their trade links, links born of economics, links born of curiosity or war, that spawned the travel and exchange that fertilised existing cultures with new ideas and then seeded completely new ones again, an ever-spiralling exchange of ideas, religion, language and art that has delivered us to now, to the globalised 21st century, though as you walk through this exhibition you realise how globalised this world has been at different times. To be able to track that story, to look back, to literally see the mark of the maker's hand on modern society, the hands of the weavers, the chiselers, the potters, the sculptors, the artists, the carvers, the gold and silversmiths in one room with 100 precious objects, I personally found incredibly humbling. Our panel tonight is both curious and learned. Before we come to them, if you are planning to tweet, you want to tweet, the hashtag tonight is 100 objects, so that's 100 in numerals and then objects. So let me kick off with Belinda, who is only here, only arrived a few days ago. It's your museum that brought us this wonderful exhibition. I want to ask, who dared have this idea and the thought that objects, through objects, we can tell this story?
Well, the basis of the exhibition dates back to 2010. It was conceived of by our former director, Neil McGregor, who is he's quite a visionary in his love of these big history narratives. And he, I believe, wanted to do something that really took full advantage of the expansive collections that the British Museum holds. So this is about as big as history gets. And appropriately enough, it was actually begun as a radio series. It was never really intended to be an exhibition. It was supposed to be a radio series, which in itself, I mean, you said that the exhibition is sort of ludicrously ambitious, but to do a radio series about objects
yes.
is also a little bit odd. So it was, on paper, quite a bizarre proposal, but it was phenomenally successful. The radio series ran in Britain and was then translated into many languages and has run in several countries. There was a book produced from it, which was translated and sold all around the world. And I think nobody really anticipated it being so globally popular, successful. And the next step, once we'd reached that point, seemed to be to do an exhibition and to actually not just take the narrative to global audiences, but to actually take the objects as well. And that presented its own challenges because it had never been conceived of for an exhibition. Some of the objects that had been chosen were woefully inadequate to tour around the world. Some of them were just far too fragile. Some were too big. So there was a process of rejigging, changing the selection slightly to maintain the original narrative and scope and ambition of the project, but actually make it feasible logistically as well.
The ambition is what makes it so attractive as a notion. You know,
absolutely,
how
yeah.
can they do this? You arrive, what is going to be in there? I'm interested in what our other three local panellists think, because all three of you are authors. All three of you use words as your livelihood, your communication tool. I'd like to ask each of you this question. Clive, I'll kick off with you. In what way objects are suitable and can be the window into the human condition in a way that words and texts are not?
I'm not sure that they can. I think the objects...
It's a failure, this exhibition.
Well, I mean, but if you think about how it's...
How it's
staged, I mean, the objects only acquire meaning when words are attached to them. It's only when we can interpret what they mean. And, you know, this is kind of a cliche in a way in daily life when we all think about the material objects that we surround ourselves with. You know, they pretty much every last one of them, particularly in modern societies, takes on meaning only because we invest them with meaning. And I think the curators have obviously done a brilliant job, but they've also invested these objects with meaning. If we walked around and we didn't read anything, we didn't have the catalogue or the captions, we really wouldn't know what to make of it. And a bunch of kind of interesting things, but what the hell are they? So really, I think it's words that give meaning and significance and importance to objects.
I think them's fighting words, but Delia, what do you think?
Well, I think we're in a strange, we're in an odd relationship with objects at the moment, because on the one hand, we live in a mass-produced age, and that's pretty obvious. And so we have this hankering in that age for the handmade, for the crafted, and particularly, I think, for the aura of some of these objects that are so unique and handcrafted and come to us from civilizations so long ago. On the other hand, objects are weird things because they do, to a certain extent, they do have a life of their own. And Kafka's written some marvelous stories, a number of stories about objects that come to life. And yet, at the same time, we're in an age where we're drowning under our own objects. One of the, we talk about the Anthropocene era and the fact that we're trying to work out when this era where climate change is human-driven comes from, and we talk about driving the golden spike and where that would be, and one of the things we talk about is maybe plastics would be one of the invention of plastics would be something where we'd drive that spike. And so I think we've got this fraught relationship with objects. I think one of the reasons that this exhibition fascinates people and attracts us, and objects attract us, is because we're kind of drawn to this aura that they have, but at the same time, I think they are, we're aware of the fact that they are, our own objects don't necessarily mean us well to the extent that we have, that we are almost being crowded out by the things that we've made.
Gideon, what do you think we can learn from objects? Do you agree with Clive that not much unless they're accompanied with a narrative?
Well, the whole exhibition looks like a kind of a metaphor. As a writer, it looks like a metaphor for the selectivity of history. You know, when we go to research a particular subject as an author, we pile up an enormous amount of information, and then we cherry pick those facts that perhaps suit our preconceived narrative or that tell the story best. So, to me, what fascinated me was why these objects have been collected, why they've been selected, what they gain from their materiality, and their authenticity. It suggests a great respect for authenticity, perhaps because of what Dealey was talking about before, the mass production age, the fact that we can see that the hand of the maker is manifested in these objects somehow speaks to us in a way that the mass-produced objects that we're surrounded by do not.
Mm. But you want to say something?
Yeah, if that's all right. No, yes. I'm afraid I disagree with you, Clive. I feel that objects, as Delia was saying, we have so many of them, but this isn't really something new. The fact that we have human-made objects from 2 million years ago, I don't think anyone now could conceive of being without objects. The things that we wear, the things that we own, they make us not only individuals, but they also represent cultures. And for that reason, I think they are phenomenally important for history, because part of what this exhibition is trying to do by looking through objects rather than the written word is to try and access those parts of our global history that we can't access through the written word. It's not possible. To try and do history through writing, you will get a very, very unbalanced view of the past.
No, what I'm saying is that the objects alone are kind of meaningless.
But you say if you go into the exhibition and you look at the object without text, it wouldn't mean anything.
Yes.
But that's not how an object is found. If you dig up an object archaeologically, you have more information about it. You don't have a label telling you what it is when you dig it out of the ground. You have to piece that together.
And build the narrative
and
around
the
it.
Narrative.
I was
so
going to ask
text
you.
Has come
but,
from
but the words
all of
give,
those
the
processes.
Words give it a meaning. Otherwise, if there were no words, each one of us would walk into the exhibition there and we would just project our own meanings onto them. We would make up our own stories
in that
about
context,
them.
Absolutely.
If we were able to pick that object up, I don't necessarily agree. I was thinking about a friend of mine the other day who is a wonderful cello player, and I was saying, the sound that you're getting out of your instrument at the moment is just amazing. He said, well, I've bought a new bow. And then he went into this fantastic disquisition about how it was a bow that was made in the 1920s and, the history of that. And he said, the thing about it is this bow is teaching me how to play my cello better. And so objects carry body memories with them as well. And I think there is something about them. Yes, they do need interpretation. But there is something about the fact that they are physical and that if they do carry a muscle memory or a body memory with them, and I think that's part of their aura that they have in addition to the verbal meanings
that
we bring to them.
Can I say something else about the timescales of this exhibition? They strike me very forcefully. As an Australian, we have a country that has a very, very ancient history and a very, very recent history. The fact that this exhibition is more or less continuous over the course of the 2 million years and often manifests things taking place simultaneously in different parts of the world, to me gives a completely different sort of, it's a completely different sense of history to that with which I'm familiar in this country.
I think the time, speaking of the time span, I mean, of 2 million years, which is phenomenal, and as you move through it and you look at the time of the origin of this, it's striking. This is so long ago. I wondered whether the question, what objects tell us about the people who made them and the communities who house them, how much of that we know, and how much, in a sense, if how much guesswork is involved? I mean, it might be educated guesswork, but is it guesswork nevertheless, the things we're attributing them in terms of what it tells us about a society or what it tells us about the wars that might have been fought around that time?
Well, to go back to what Clive was saying about the interpretation labels, they are interpretations. These aren't... We can't see what went on in the past like it was recorded on a video camera. That's just not possible. We have to interpret it through what we conjecture, through what we understand from different contexts and what we can place on those objects. So what you're reading in the interpretation panels is just an interpretation. And also, as Clive said, if you go in and you want to interpret them differently, that's a legitimate way of approaching those objects. There's the sort of research approach, and there's the personal approach, and I think both have a valid place.
Do you? I wonder if the panelists who've only seen it not long ago, an hour or two ago, if you were happy to and absolutely believed the context that was put around it and everything that was attributed to that in terms of its importance in the tracing of the history of...
Well, there's a sort of meta question there because it's presented... Look, it's a brilliant exhibition.
No, we all love it.
Everyone should go and see it.
We love it. It's fantastic.
But I don't think we should sit here and just gush.
No, we
need to think about it.
Of course.
And it's presented as a history of the world. Mm. Well, I mean, Delia and I were talking as we walked through. Well, there was no world until 300 or 400 years ago. So what does it mean to talk about a history of the world? Mm. I mean, what it is a collection of stories about parts of the world that have been put together in an exhibition. And when we walk out of it, I mean, there's massive amounts of wow factors. You go in there for a wow factor, you'll get it in spades. Mm. But what do you come out with? I mean, do I understand the history of the world as a result? Can one understand the history of the world?
Well, and I think it's interesting, it's called a history of the world,
absolutely.
Not the history of the world.
And that was stressed, but you know, what does that mean? I mean, I don't understand the difference.
Well, it means you can tell another history with another set of objects or another set of narratives, can't
well,
you?
Well, a friend of mine who's an anthropologist, he does a lot of work with the Mi'kmaq people in Alaska. I think I've got this right. And he was talking to one of the... senior men, they're not called that, but the kind of equivalent of the senior men. And he was talking about how once Alaska was connected to Russia across the Bering Strait, and this is how the Mi'kmaq people, according to the archaeologists and so on, got there. And he talked about, you know, he was talking to him about how extraordinary it was that his people had come across from Russia. And he said, oh, no. We came out of the ground. I mean, we grew here. We emerged from the ground. And, of course, my anthropologist friend was kind of stumped by this. He wasn't going to say, oh, no, you got it completely wrong. So, you know, is there any number of histories?
Well, is the exhibition a sort of a cultural artefact in its own right? Because it obtains its energy from the huge discrepancy in scales, doesn't it? 100 objects, history of the world. 2 million years, one room. Is that kind of analogous to our own desire to sort of compress everything, to abbreviate everything, to truncate everything? It's a kind of an act of almost digital compression, isn't it? So what does it tell us about our own attitudes to history and to timescales?
Well, I think absolutely it's the structure of the exhibition is something born out of the Western Enlightenment, you know, the need to categorise and order.
Yes.
I mean, some cultures don't even have a concept of linear time, so having a chronological formats would not be a legitimate way of looking at history. So yes, you're absolutely right, this is a history, because this exhibition was conceived in Britain. Had it been conceived in other parts of the world, I imagine it would be a very different exhibition.
And a little later, I might ask all of you to think what you might think is missing here. But this notion that Clive said there was no world until several hundred years ago, I mean, I think that is striking. I'm not a particularly astute student of history, but it struck me that so far back in time, there were clear links across great swathes of the earth that were connected, that were very connected, obviously through trade and exchange, perhaps through war as well, but there's several objects there that really make that link. And we get to the Vikings trade links, and that's more extensive than I ever knew. And I think that's right back. That lyre, the first lyre we see in the very start of the exhibition, is an example of that, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. And I mean, it's true that a truly globalised world is quite a recent phenomenon, but what's you see before that, and something that I find very interesting in the earlier sections of the exhibition, is you can see certain developments appearing in different parts of the world that are not in contact with each other. So in the second section, or the third section really, of the exhibition, we look at very early writing. So we look at the development of writing in Mesopotamia for bureaucratic purposes, and then later on for epic narratives. But then you also have a Chinese vessel with an inscription on the inside, and an Olmec mask from Central America with glyphs on the side. And these were not cultures that were necessarily in direct contact, certainly not the Olmecs and the Mesopotamians. And yet these developments were springing up in different parts of the world, I wouldn't say simultaneously, but within short periods, relatively short periods of history, same with agricultural production and so on, and certain religious ideas you find cropping up again and again in very diverse cultures.
Is there a sense of death about it? Is there a desire? Is there an eye on eternity? Is there a desire to create objects that will outlast the maker, or to somehow arrest time with the consciousness, you know, man is the only creature that knows that it's going to die? Is there a desire to kind of leave a trace, a lasting trace that transcends a human timescale? And that's common to across cultures?
I'm not... That's quite a big question. I would probably say you probably find that mostly in the religious imagery we have in the exhibition, which is a very important theme in itself.
Yes.
But yes, certainly those objects seem to be transcendental in their very nature. But I think this is another nice thing about the exhibition. You have those sort of very grand objects, but then you have the mundane objects, the cookery pots that have been broken and discarded, which are obviously not designed to outlast. They're very functional, practical goods. So it's the variety in what material goods can do and the variety in the functions that they fulfil.
Talking of mundane objects, why don't we interrupt now to see what we can bring here to the table to expand the history of the world. Each one of you has been asked to bring in an object that has a significance for you and your life and the way you've developed in your life. Your history, if you like. Can I ask, why don't you start, Gideon? Each of you to show the object to the audience and then speak about its significance.
Yeah, all right. Well, this is a very recent piece of history, and it's incredibly trivial. But, of course, it would be my equivalent in the exhibition of the Aztec ball game waistband. This is my premiership medal for the South Yarra Cricket Club won 2 years ago. After 40 years of playing club cricket to no end, to no possible end. I deserve that. Anyway, I'd played club cricket since I was 9, never won a premiership, had begun to think, well, look, if I don't win a premiership, I won't feel as though my time has been wasted. I won't have led a life of complete futility. I've still enjoyed the process. And then, quite unexpectedly, after 7 losing grand finals at my club, I won this 2 years ago. And then almost immediately lost it because I gave it to my daughter for her jewellery box. And I asked for it back a week later and we couldn't find it. It was actually in with her Thomas the Tank Engine set. It was in Tidmouth Sheds, but my wife very cleverly recovered it. So it's a symbol of kind of striving and a symbol of, not of supremacy, but enjoyment of the contest. And it's something that I'm not going to give back to my daughter now because I've decided that after losing it, it's just too traumatic.
And if we found that in 300 years exactly. hence, what could it tell us about Gideon? Yeah. It would tell us this was an older male who clearly loved to play cricket but wasn't very good at it because it took him to lose quite late in life to win a medal. Delia.
Well, I've brought in a copper ashtray, which has been sitting in my family house all my childhood. As you can see, unlike the worked copper that I have in my hand, which is also Chilean, this is looks to me like an unworked ingot. And it's very heavy. It's a wonderful hand feel about it. This is a souvenir of, or I suppose a memento of my grandfather's work as a mine manager of El Teniente mines for Braden Copper, which is one of the great copper mines of South America, in Rancagua in Chile. And I'm not as interested in it in itself as I am in it as a symbol of a great submerged history in my family, and that is that my grandmother was Chilean, and her cherished older brother was the first martyr of Chilean aviation in 1911. And this ashtray has taken me on a search to Chile last year to try and find what I could find of this history that my grandmother would not speak about. And it took me to the relic that I couldn't bring in, which I think is going to be projected on screen now, which is, on this search, I came across the propeller of the Manuel Rodriguez, which is the plane that my great-uncle is standing, Teniente Francisco Mary is standing next to here, in the global pose of all aviators of that era, with his elbow on that same propeller. And so I was able to track tracking his history and some of the family history. I could track to the site of trauma, which is where all this there is so much unspoken trauma and disaster still running through my family from this event. And I was able to actually go and hold the remains of that propeller that had been inscribed in my hands in the small museum at the Air School in El Bosque, which is still where it was when he was flying there on the edges of Santiago. And that was a tremendously affecting object, very heavy thing to hold. And it was very eerie knowing that the rest of the plane had actually been buried on those grounds like a holy relic, which I think is sort of deeply strange and deeply intriguing, but gives you a sense of what a traumatic event that was in Chilean history when they were, the Air Force was the absolute epitome of their entry into modernity, and they saw themselves as the most modern country in South America.
That's fantastic, and that
all stems from this.
All stems
copper
from that
ink,
keeping
this copper
your sort of Chilean identity
yes.
alive and forcing you to,
yes.
or propelling you to go
yes.
and find out more
yes.
about it. That's wonderful, Clive.
I actually, when I asked this question, I thought I had trouble identifying an object to which I have a strong sentimental attachment. So I hope my wife isn't listening. I'm sure there's some object in the house which does represent our long marriage. But now this is just a meaningless rock. But in a few minutes it won't be, this, to illustrate my point. This rock is from the Strelley Ranges in the Pilbara. And it is 3.4 billion years old. That's three quarters of the age of the Earth, 3.4 billion years old. And it's significant because there are certain structures you can see here in different facets of this rock, which are called stromatolites. And these stromatolites were left by microbes, which were the very first form of life on planet Earth. So this represents a kind of, more than represents, is, embodies the emergence of life on planet Earth. And the reason this is, to me, very significant, this rock actually sits on my balcony and kind of emanates meaning. And I look at it and think about it a lot. And the reason is because I've just finished, in fact, yesterday I sent the manuscript of a book on the Anthropocene off to the publishers, and that is the meaning of the Anthropocene, this new geological epoch that humankind has brought to planet Earth. The first time in 4.5 billion years of life on the planet, its geological evolution is being influenced by a conscious, willing force. And so what has happened in the Anthropocene is that human history, which is told in this exhibition, has converged for the very first time with geological history. And so humans have become agents, not just in history is usually defined as the story since the emergence of writing and prehistory prior to that, but for the very first time, humans have entered into deep history. Belinda mentioned, you know, the exhibition is about an exhibition about big history. This is big history. So I just have this strong, powerful sense that this rock has a cosmic meaning, a cosmic message, not necessarily in itself, but it's our connection with this rock is enormously important.
It's fantastic that you have that rock and that it connects to you like that every time you see it. And it strikes me too that, as you say, the interaction between humans and deep geological
deep
history.
Time, yeah.
I mean, the objects, not all of them in the exhibition, but certainly in modern day, that's what we're talking about. The making, the creating of these, the manufacturing of these objects is one of the key reasons why we are having such a big impact on
on
that. And did you write Affluenza? Was that you?
Yes.
I mean, Affluenza was all about, a book Clive wrote a long time ago now, was all about our need to acquire more things, in a way, more objects, which, and that need is what's creating, you know, well, part of the problem that's driving the rate of change and impact on the climate too, so, and on the geology. Really interesting, Clive.
Well, indeed, and I was just thinking about this process of investing objects with meaning, and I mean, in a way, that's what our societies do overwhelmingly. You know, the marketing industry, which is vast, is all about investing objects with meaning. So, for example, a pair of jeans which sells for $200 made in a Bangladesh sweatshop, you know, the value of the labour and the materials is about $20. You know, there's probably another $80 of distribution and retail margins and so on and so forth. And the $100 left over is really about marketing. It's money spent on convincing us that this isn't just a functional object that keeps your legs warm, but actually will make you a cool, funky kind of person. And I think about this when, you know, I think about those women in those factories in Bangladesh, and they've made this, you know, beautiful pair of jeans, and then the supervisor comes along with some box cutters and said, now slash them.
Yeah, what
because
do they make of that?
Because people in the West will actually pay more for them.
I know. Don't even go to the stupidity
sure,
of that.
They have teams of specialist slashers.
Well, they do, because if the slashing's wrong, you know they're cheap.
Yeah,
Belinda,
right.
Your item.
Right, my item.
Let's remove the... how old was that rock?
3.42 billion years.
Amazing. Right.
No pressure. Picking it up there.
Yeah. It's the only one that he's allowed to drop.
No, you can drop
his,
these. It's fine.
Not on his toe.
So I brought in my very first pair of glasses that I got when I was 14. And when I was first told to bring something in, I was desperately trying to think of something that that was meaningful to me, that I had a connection with. And then I realized that I was completely oblivious to the object that was literally sitting on my face and that I really can't do anything without. I think everyone who, I don't know, but I imagine everyone who wears glasses remembers that first time when they put them on and realizing what you hadn't been seeing before. And now I can't do anything without my glasses, but also these for me sum up that sort of awkward teenager who desperately didn't want to wear glasses. Yes. So if I had to, I was going to get the most expensive ones I could possibly find. I don't think they suit me. I don't think they ever really suited me, but they were going to be fancy.
Gucci,
yes. Only the best. The other reason, they really got me thinking after a while, the other reason I bought them is I still have them. They're broken. They've got one lens. I can't fix them. They're the wrong prescription.
Yeah. Why do you still have them?
Why do I still have them? Yeah. I think there's this strange phenomenon that we tend to form attachments to material things.
Yeah.
And it is illogical. Mm. It's like what you're saying. It is illogical to hoard all this, all of these things. But I still have these glasses.
Some years ago, I was researching the life of an Australian cricket administrator, and I managed to track down a trunk load of his papers and personal effects. And the thing that most profoundly impressed me was his glasses.
Yeah.
There was a set of his glasses in there from, 100 years earlier. They're so intimate to the wearer.
They're quite personal objects.
They're something that probably no one else touched in his life, but they're so uniquely his.
Yeah.
I felt, when I handled them, I was very, very close to him.
Yeah. There's also another reason, if you don't mind, that got me thinking about these, is that it's something that the exhibition doesn't really touch on, is the medical advances. Mm. But what we do see throughout the exhibition is, the development of human communities, increasingly getting bigger and bigger, urbanisation, the development of the printing press, all factors which contribute to changing human health and well-being. And from I'm no scientist, but from what I understand, myopia is largely created by, exacerbated by not using one's peripheral vision enough, from being in a more focused environment, by being in smaller spaces, by reading a lot. So the big issues that are covered in the exhibition lead on to other issues like needing glasses for a lot of the population and the differences between urban populations and rural populations in these sort of physical changes to humans.
It's funny because I was saying to Belinda that I nearly brought specs in too. I'm wearing contact lenses, but I'm terribly short-sighted. And one of the other things I was thinking about with glasses was when they were invented. I think the first people to get glasses were monks in monasteries, weren't they, from memory? And then I think as a woman, when would I have had the chance to get glasses? How many hundreds of years would I have had to wait to be able to have this technology that would allow me to be in the world? I have a desperate phobia of losing my glasses. The terrible scene where Piggy has his glasses smashed in
Lord of the Flies.
And I do think that reminded me of how, we have these advances in technology, but we must not assume that everyone gets access to them at the same time.
Glasses were one of the winning entries in our competition too. And another thing that, in fact, the first one I read out, I was really struck by, I thought it was very moving, was you talked about not much mention of the medical developments, but one person named the syringe.
Yeah.
And because the syringe gave them life, saved them life, and he said for him and for his children, it was the difference between them living beyond 14 and himself living beyond 14 to the age of whatever he is now, 47 or something.
It's a perfect segue, because if you were, Fran, going to ask us which object we would include in the exhibition...
I am going to ask you that.
Would you like me
to ask you that?
No, I'm going to answer it anyway. This.
A tablet? Is it?
Contraceptive pill.
Oh, contraceptive pill.
I mean, this had an amazing impact on the world when it was first introduced in the 1960s.
You're just carrying one around with you.
Yeah, I just happen to have one on my For women to be able to control their fertility and for men to be able to exploit the capacity of women to control their own fertility had an enormous social impact. And so
that was another one of our winners, actually.
Really?
Yeah, runners-up, but
I missed that. Well, I mean, it kind of launched the sexual revolution, and I would suggest that the energy that was generated in the sexual revolution spilt over into all of those other social movements and powered them, the movements of the 60s and 70s.
Changed the lives of women, unhooked us, really.
Massively. Mm. So this tiny object has had a massive influence on the world.
Well, that is a perfect segue, Clive. Let me bring us back to the exhibition now. Thank you, all of you. Incredibly thoughtful contributions. And
representations of yourselves. There are many, to come back to the exhibition itself, there are many groupings of objects in this exhibition in terms of faith and religion and culture and creativity and faith and beauty. Money and wealth and power are big ones, and we might come to power in a moment. But another theme is just the notion of the human capacity for ideas and innovation. And we start way back with the Olduvai hand axe, the first hand axe that I think it was... I think it was Gideon who said, how do we know that's actually just not a rock? But the bust of Sophocles and what that represents, the Hebrew astrolabe, the how do you say WLAN, the Wi-Fi, the CSIRO Wi-Fi, the indigenous basket. I wonder if each of you, if I could ask each of you, Gideon, I'll start with you,
sure.
If you were satisfied with the representation selected to represent human ideas, innovation, ingenuity,
yeah.
Because we could have chosen... Well, we could have chosen the wheel, we could have chosen the X-ray machine.
Yeah.
What do you think, Gideon?
The innovation that always comes to my mind is double entry bookkeeping. Which seriously, it's a major breakthrough. Luca de Pacioli's
it always comes to my mind too.
Seriously,
you know?
It is. Because it's been used sort of almost continuously for 700-800 years, and it underpins every modern corporation just
yep.
as it did every tiny business in sort of in Florence in the 1400s. It's such a subversive and powerful idea, and a kind of an error detection tool for accountants ever since. Mm. Not quite sure how you'd manifest it in an exhibition, but maybe I always think of that
a ledger.
The merchant, yeah, a ledger. There's a very famous collection of ledgers and business correspondence by by the Merchant of Arrigo, is it? Florence Dettini, whose sort of business letters, hundreds of thousands of business letters and accounting ledgers, was found sort of virtually intact about 100 years ago, and shows just how long and how continuous the process of organising a business has been. It's kind of instantly recognisable to anyone who's running a business today.
There's a wonderful book written about this, the history of the modern accounting, and it's great.
Yes.
Okay, the ledger for you, Delia?
I think something to do with cinema. Cinema or photography, those that are sort of technologies of thought as well as actual physical technologies. I think that as soon as we start to see ourselves from the outside, to see ourselves,
yes.
Especially to see the face projected on the big screen, that we become different sorts of people. I
yes.
think we enter a different era of being. And I think that, for me, one of the iconic moments that I would possibly want to see in the exhibition would be that photograph of the Earth from space,
yes.
where
yes.
we have... where I think that capacity to not be
yeah.
looking up at the universe from our world and imagining what it's like, but to actually look down and see that fragility of it from space, and to see it as a small entity in a grand scheme is one of the, you know, it should be more of a game changer in terms of how we live in the world now, but it's certainly a game changer in terms of our perception of humanity and the planet.
Yeah, Clive, I'll come to you in a moment, but there is no representation of space. Now, maybe that doesn't fit in with the British Museum's collection.
I mean, that's essentially what it comes down to. All of the objects in the exhibition are from the British Museum's collection, which has a history in itself about how that collection was formed.
Mm.
And it would be wonderful to have an X-ray machine in the exhibition, but we don't have an X-ray machine in the British Museum.
Mm.
So there are limiting factors such as like that. But I don't. We don't. We're not. The British Museum is not a science and technology
yes, of course.
Institution, because there are so many very good specialist museums who look at that. So we wouldn't actually have the collection to put something from the modern age of space travel in the exhibition. But having said that, I do think it's a wonderful idea, and even having a moon rock or something at the end, so it's not just about this world, it's actually moving elsewhere. And I mean, some of the objects were actually acquired specially for the project, so maybe we could have been a little bit more ambitious than just a football shirt.
Clive, you've given us the contraception pill, but is there another thing briefly that sort of you would have had there to display human innovation? And
I mean, I just comment on Delia's observation about the Apollo 9, I think it was, photos from space. What she says is true, but other people saw it quite differently, and other people saw it in engineering terms. Here's this object, the Earth on which we live. We can see it in totality. We can control it. We can dominate it. And so it has a quite a different, more
others
sinister...
Others saw it and say we can save it.
...reading. Well, that's the kind of typical reading of it. You know, this fragile, beautiful blue marble... but others don't see it that way.
It should be a game changer for how we behave.
Exactly, yes. But the game changer, which I'd mention, and it's kind of banal but obvious, and that is the steam engine. I mean, from the late 18th century, it transformed the world. It had made fossil fuels exploitable on a large scale, and it's that connects us to rock over there, that we've become planet terraformers.
And Belinda, you've travelled with this exhibition. It's nearly a million people have seen this exhibition now. In fact, we hope that while it's here, we will click over the millionth person. I don't know if they get a prize, but through all those people who have come through it, is there something that has come up again and again as people thinking, or has there been a critique of something obvious that is not missing, that is missing?
Not so much. I mean, I'm sure people will come to it with their own ideas of what should and shouldn't be present. But so I think because we have been relatively flexible with the format in that we have this final section, which is when we invite the host institution to choose an object to put in the exhibition. So I think this is really quite fascinating. Having been able to travel with the exhibition to various venues and seeing the different ways that different institutions from different world cultures approach this problem has just been completely fascinating. And I think that's where the exhibition becomes more personal, more local. And really, the only remit that we give is that it should be something that represents the modern world, some object which showcases the world that we live in today. But we've had responses which include technological advances. Actually, space travel was one of them. Or spirituality, connections with past heritage. There's a lot of scope for interpreting that.
There's... I think one of you talked earlier about the selectivity of history. And obviously this has been a huge selective process to go through the British Museum and work it down to 100 objects that can represent the history of the world. There's some crossover, I suppose, in what we've been saying, but as you walked through too, I wonder if there's some gaps there. You think there's a gap in periods that aren't represented? Is there a missing kind of moment rather than a thing?
Well, the 20th century, the last two centuries are so incredibly compressed, or perhaps you're disproportionately aware of them because you have lived through that period. But, you know, we always talk about the acceleration of technology it's almost like we're living in dog years at the moment. So much seems to be accomplished so quickly. And one thing I didn't think that the exhibition came to terms with was man's destructive capacities. I sort of thought maybe you could have had something like a cooling rod from Chicago Pile 1, you know, the first nuclear reactor to achieve criticality, because it is unique in the last two generations that we've actually had the capacity to destroy mankind. That power's never been within our reach before. And somehow we managed to exist despite this shadow hanging over us, this capacity for instantaneous destruction. That seems to me to be a significant game changer. Yes.
Okay. Well, on that, I'd like to go to one or two objects that I just didn't understand why they were selected. I don't know if this is burrowing down too deeply in the time we have left, because in about 10 minutes I will be asking you if you have some questions. But for instance, the bust of Sophocles. Delia, you're all writers, you're a novelist. I mean, why Sophocles? Why not Plato? Why not Shakespeare? Why not Chaucer? Why not? What did you think about that choice of Sophocles? Or perhaps should I get Belinda to give us a... No, I'll get your thoughts first and then Belinda can explain why Sophocles was selected.
I have no thoughts on the bust of Sophocles, actually.
Well, then let me skip you.
No, the object that... I'd rather talk about an object that really struck me. We were talking about destructive capacity, and one of the things I think in this exhibition that you know, I would possibly like to see more is more of a sense of the unevenness of culture, of progress, of access to goods and access to citizenship, I suppose. You know, but one brings those things to the exhibition. There are exhibits that clearly relate to the history of slavery, but I think that isn't interpreted for you. You have to bring that to a certain extent. But the exhibit that I found really most fascinating in the whole exhibition is the beautiful hand, Talab Riyam from Yemen. And it's the most exquisite in itself. It's an exquisite object. It's a distinctly Arab hand. It's with beautiful, long, tapered fingers. It's very different to, say, the sort of square Roman or Greek hands that one is so used to seeing. And that is a hand that is related to a local god. And one of the things that I thought about in this exhibition, the sort of thoughts that I think are really fertile from this exhibition, was just I thought about the fact that... Across from around about that period, 100 to 300 AD and onwards, you have this disappearance of all these tiny local gods and religions across the world, country to country. And I suppose as a writer, I've always had a sympathy for, I'm always fascinated by those early pagan or local and lost religions. I was very moved by that, but it was fascinating also to see that was replaced by global religions, and then that some of those global religions, like Zoroastrianism, are now themselves disappearing. So we have this as the other global religions rise. And for me, that was so eloquent in containing such an enormous history in this one object.
That's very interesting, because I will forget Sophocles, because clearly I'm the only one perturbed by that. But
I'll explain it to you after.
I too thought the hand was extraordinarily beautiful, but I wondered why it was selected as part of the 100 objects. Now, I understand the story, and you explained it so beautifully then, I think, didn't she, Belinda?
Yeah.
But I did wonder about its place in that select group.
But could I just take up the theme that both Gideon and Delia have mentioned, and that is, look, I mean, it'd be an impossible job, and I've no doubt at all that the 10 curators who got together and probably spent 2 years thinking about what should we include, incredibly difficult job, and, you know, all power to them. And of course, we all have our own particular views, but I too thought that the overall message of the exhibition is kind of, wow, aren't we amazing as human beings? Look what we've done, look how much we've progressed. But humans are responsible for an enormous amount of evil, and none more so than the 20th century. And so perhaps, you know, something from Auschwitz would be a very stark reminder.
But then which evil would you choose?
Well, you only need one.
I mean, if you look at the objects in the final section, there are a lot which are connected with war and conflict. Yeah. The Russian Revolution, the war in Afghanistan, even intertribal conflicts, the Mozambique Civil War. You've got different types of war, civil war, revolution, global warfare represented there. That's quite a good proportion of the objects in that final section are connected to warfare. So, I mean, you're absolutely right in saying that we are lacking that sort of the sort of wide-scale destructive capacity of humankind, and maybe an object from Hiroshima or something like that would have brought that to bear more more pointedly. Mm. So there are gaps in that sense. Mm. But
there is a narrative through it from way back of conquering, you know, domination,
yeah, absolutely.
Which, of course, yeah. We all understand to be yeah. war and portraits of warriors. Yeah. And so the notion of war is well yeah. represented.
And I don't think it's necessarily being celebrated as such as just put forward for consideration. That's how I would see it. But I can understand how... since the exhibition does progress in a sort of chronological and technologically more sophisticated way, perhaps there is a danger that it's being sort of celebrated a bit more than was the original intention.
Delia, just one more question before I go to the notion of the museum overall. Delia loved the hand. Gideon, did you give us a favourite?
Yeah, I loved the Dura rhinoceros. When I was a kid, we had a Dura print up on the wall at home, and I just was absolutely fascinated by the craftsmanship and the lineaments of his etchings. And then a couple of years ago, probably can't see this, but my daughter, we went to the National Gallery, and my daughter bought me as a key ring the Dura rhinoceros, just because she liked the look of it, and I thought, you know, isn't it wonderful that it speaks to a 4-year-old? Now my daughter's loves drawing, painting. I'm actually wearing a work of her art tonight on my T-shirt. I just loved the fact that it reached out across 500 years and captured the imagination of a tiny child.
Yeah, it's sensational. Clive, did you have a favourite?
I was struck by the Buddha head from Borobudur in Indonesia, simply because of the irony of including a symbol of detachment from material objects in an exhibition celebrating the power and importance of material objects.
Yeah, he's our resident contrarian.
There's an irony in even that object existing in the first place, and that's part of the beauty of it. This fantastically expensive and massive monument is created to celebrate detachment from material objects.
Belinda, do you have a favourite?
I do have a favourite. My personal favourite is the Victorian tea set, because I think it's very symbolic in a way of British imperialism at that time.
The Wedgwood
tea set. It's got a lot of stories which feed into it, which I won't go into all of them now because we don't have time. But one which I really love is that it is sort of quintessentially the symbol of refined Britishness, and yet in order to fill that tea set with tea, we have two wars between Britain and China, the British obsession with getting tea, undermining Chinese society through the trade of opium, leading to two conflicts. So the symbol of peaceful tranquility is actually resting on quite brutal imperialism.
And the Chinese chip on the shoulder that's still being played out today.
Mm. Well, these things still have ramifications that we are experiencing now.
I'm going to come to you in a moment, but this whole exhibition brings up a question that perhaps is always brought up for the British Museum from the beginning of time, which is it was the first public museum in the world with a mission to be a museum of the world for the world. There remains a question about appropriation around museums like yours.
Absolutely.
Is this exhibition in some way an answer to those concerns, do you think? Because here it is on display that one place has been able to preserve the story of the development of the world, if you like, through objects, that without the British Museum we would not have this range of objects to bring together, or is it proof of it?
I mean, it sort of does both, really. It's true that the British Museum does have a collection in which you can put on an exhibition like that with objects from all around the world. But the very fact that we can put on such an exhibition raises uncomfortable questions about why we have all of those collections. And as I said before, the British Museum is an institution with a 300-year-old history of its own, and British culture and world culture has changed dramatically in that time. And it is appropriate that we constantly reevaluate what these institutions do, how they serve the modern world. The British Museum was founded in the mid-18th century. We do not live in that world anymore. But I do think that there is a legitimate case to be made for the importance of having global collections together in one place, especially in the modern world when cultures, I feel, particularly in some parts of the world, there is a tendency to become culturally isolated from one another and to withdraw behind barricades. Mm. And this is really the time when learning about different cultures is more important than ever, and museums can contribute to that.
And we've just seen the terrible destruction of Palmyra by ISIS, yeah, which has raised a whole lot of these questions. But let me ask the panel just briefly, before we go to the audience, what role you think museums around the world do play, should play, if any role, in collecting and exhibiting objects and preserving, I guess. Who wants to take that?
Look, I take up Belinda's point that I think that museums have a sort of double job. One is obviously to preserve objects, but the other is to remind us of the history of collection and the history of organising the world. And I suppose I have a problem myself. I take my kids to museums a lot at the moment, and I think that museums that start to orientate themselves around entertainment, that are too selective sometimes around their exhibitions, there's a place for those, but I think that it's really, it's really important to be able to connect with an understanding of the old systems that we used to classify the world, yeah, to the you know, whether it was sort of the Linnaean systems or whether it's evolutionary systems, to actually be able to see that visually represented and to understand that as a fundamental in your culture, I think is still really important, and I would hate, yeah, to see museums lose that.
Okay. Well, unless the other two panellists have strong views on this, I'm going to throw to the audience now. Do either of you want to
add
anything?
I was just going to say my favourite museum in the world is the Sir John Soane's Museum in London, which is just the reflection of one guy's fascination with stuff.
Yeah,
it's like a tour of the interior of his head, and it's I go there every time I go to London, and there's always something I've forgotten, and I go, wow, you know, what possessed him to put that back together? In some respects, a museum should kind of put us in touch with our sort of common humanity, and you know, touch off our own sort of instincts to preserve and to value.
Well, so it's exactly those kind of collections that formed the British Museum in the first place. I mean, that is what we are building on now. Mm.
Okay, now we just have time for 10 minutes or so of questions, I think. If anyone would like to ask a question of the panel, just put up your hand and we'll get a microphone to you. Okay, there's a hand up at the back. If I could just ask you to perhaps say your name and ask a question rather than give us a statement, because time is tight. Thanks. Caroline, can we hear you?
Can you hear me okay? That's good.
Yeah, we can.
I was a bit concerned about that rotating disc when we came in, but now I know what it's for. And I was just wondering, Fran, what you would have put on there had you been asked to.
It's a really hard question, and it got sort of sprung on me on the radio station, and I hadn't been too busy prepping an interview with Tanya Plibersek or somebody to think about it. And on the spur of the moment, I'm not sure that I'm happy with this, but I did say the ball. Because at that moment I was particularly riveted by football grand final and a particular team that I support. But through my life and the development of me within my family, I'm sort of known as the person who throws a ball around all the time. If I can't walk past a ball without picking it up. And through that, I became very involved with sort of teamwork and physical sort of activity and encouragement. And I think it taught me a lot of skills that have so I've carried through me to my development of my career, which is, you know, working in teams, preferring to work in teams, understanding what leadership is and how that can move in and out of a group, and the sort of the camaraderie and enthusiasm.
How to shirt front someone.
Well, the role for enthusiasm and perhaps the role to shirt front someone if it's appropriate. However, I hadn't thought of that. So for me, it's a ball, but I didn't bring one in. Any other questions? Yes.
Just to Clive, if you could, my name's Alison, and just your object, which is stunning, how did you come by it, and how would you feel if you found out it wasn't genuine?
Great question.
That's a good question.
Yeah, well, we're into authenticity. Mm. I have a friend, Andrew Glickson, who's a well-known geologist who, among other things, has done a lot of work on the impact of asteroid strikes on the Earth and how they've transformed the global climate. I was visiting him at his place, and in his backyard, he was full of rocks. And he just started to tell me about these rocks, and including that one, I said, can I have it? And he said, sure. Mm-hmm. So I took it home. I mean, it's worth two bob, you know. You know, it's just a rock. There are millions of them out in the Pilbara from these particular formations. So, yeah, I'm sure it's genuine. I do wonder how Andrew gets these rocks back to Canberra in a plane. I mean, the excess baggage must be
incredible.
Killer, yeah.
I'm just going to just finish my narrative on the ball. I was very heartened to see that what made it within the 100 objects was the first a symbol representing the first ball game. So that made me feel a little better about my choice. Mm. Anybody else up there? This is probably our last question, I have to say.
Hi, I'm Lois. Do you feel that the exhibition reinforces or challenges the Enlightenment's view of the progress of civilization? Because that idea really impacted on how Aboriginal people were treated in colonization, the idea they were Stone Age, you know, backward people who didn't use land and didn't own it, all the terra nullius stuff. So in looking at an exhibition about the history of the world and civilization, as I said, do you feel that that reinforces or challenges those Enlightenment ideas?
Who wants to take that? Yes, go, Belinda.
Well, there are sort of two sides there. In one sense, as I mentioned, it is a very much in keeping with the Enlightenment idea of order, categorize, compare. This is how you approach the world. This is how you approach history.
Impose meaning to things.
Yeah. But I would say that actually it's the kind of imperial Enlightenment idea about the supremacy of Western civilization over all other cultures, civilizations, is not, was certainly not the intention. And I don't think comes across, simply because one of the reasons of doing this exhibition through objects was to access those cultures that didn't have writing, who tended to be the ones that the Western cultures, the European cultures, invaded. Mm. Writing is very, as I mentioned right at the beginning, writing is very restricted. It's a very relatively modern invention, and it's limited to only a few cultures worldwide, or it used to be, at least. So in order to access the voices of the Native American people, the South American people, the Indigenous Australians pre the invasion, is only possible through objects. And that's why this exhibition approaches history in that way.
Does anyone else in the panel want to add to that?
I had some thoughts about this as I was walking through it, and one is that it's a very democratic exhibition, but underlying it is this idea, this Enlightenment idea, not of the grandness of the European vision and conquest, but of the grandeur of humankind. Mm. That's the kind of fundamental message I get from it. But let me add this. Arguably, it's too democratic, that in fact, if you look at the world today, it has been profoundly influenced by what happened in Europe in the 17th, 18th and 19th century and 20th centuries, Europe and America. I mean, that's just the fact that you know, one can interpret that in terms of cultural superiority, but the truth is the technological and military power of Europe has shaped the world that we live in today. And I don't think that's because of the democratic urge of the curators. I don't think that is reflected in the exhibition.
Belinda, I know you've got something you want to say about that, because so do I, but you go.
I think that a lot of inventions now are based on older inventions, and those are not necessarily European inventions. The Islamic Middle East, China, were incredibly advanced cultures, probably before Europe. Europe was a bit of a late starter. If you look at the second section in the exhibition, you will see the phenomenal bronze working in China at the same time that we know next to nothing about what was happening in Western Europe. Those
but the Chinese used gunpowder for fireworks, and Europeans used it to kill people.
And that was an advance.
Well, they also invented... The Chinese also invented weapons like the crossbow.
It changed the world.
I don't think it's fair to say that all the best inventions are European. I don't think that's an accurate reflection of history at all.
The dominant ones have been, undoubtedly.
But I think you're thinking of recent history.
Well, you know, the world changed with the industrial Western and scientific revolutions. I mean, there's absolutely no comparison. And the idea that we can just draw a kind of continuous line back of constant development is, you know, is just not historical. I mean, things went like this.
But I think, Clive, and I'm going to pull this back now because we have to wrap this up, but I think there you could certainly look at the early part of that exhibition and look at the degree of sophistication of idea and capacity to invent and manufacture and create and see that there was a whole period of great creativity and
absolutely
influence that...
Which was suppressed by the European colonialism. There's no doubt about that. But if you look at how power actually transformed the world, it came from Europe.
Ladies and gentlemen, could you please thank the panel, Belinda Creer, Clive Hamilton, Gideon Haig and Delia Faulkner. Terrific discussion, and I'm sure that if you've seen the exhibition, you'll agree how fabulous it is. So that although there may have been some contrarians amongst us tonight, and all of us may have taken issue with Belinda on a few things, I think it's fair to say, well, certainly from my point of view, it is a fantastic list of significant objects that create a particular story that is very powerful, and really just the being amongst the objects, I found the most moving thing at all. Forget the narrative. Thank you. Thank you.
Indeed, I think it's a measure of the success of the exhibition that we have had a very stimulating and thought-provoking debate this evening. It wouldn't be a blockbuster exhibition, and this might not delight Clive in terms of the fetishising of the material world, but it wouldn't be a blockbuster exhibition without merchandise. And in fact, we have a show bag. It might delight Gideon, actually, because in the show bag is a cushion cover of Dura's Rhinoceros. And a very special duck. This one is of a Roman centurion, I think. But you know.
Thank you.
So thank you again to our panellists, Fran Kelly, Belinda Creer, Clive Hamilton, Delia Faulkner and Gideon Haig.
Thank you. Thanks very much, mate. Thank you. Thanks all.
I'd now also just like to thank everybody who put tonight together, to the great staff at the National Museum again who've worked so hard, Luke Cummins and his team, Media Services, Tracy Sutherland, who've done an exceptional job in recent weeks really putting this together, and to invite you, great audience, to all join us now together with panel members in the old New Land Gallery downstairs for complimentary refreshments. And that's a little different for those of you who are frequent attendees of these kinds of events. It's not down in the main hall because we have, surprisingly, another function tonight in the main hall. So we're going to ask you just to go downstairs. Some staff will show you where to go and to enjoy a drink and to ruminate on the exhibition and the discussion that you've heard tonight. And I'd also just ask you kindly, when you exit the building, you'll be shown through one of the side doors, just because of that function in the main hall. The museum staff will be on hand to guide you in the appropriate direction. I also want to thank very much our fantastic wine sponsors, Capital Wines, for their support of the event. Capital Wines is a 5-star James Halliday Winery of the Canberra District, which is well known for its cool climate wines. I recommend them to you, even though I have been very abstemious of recent months. Thanks again to all of you, and please join us downstairs for a drink.
Exhibition, will they get a prize?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, because I hadn't quite realised it was a millionth person. It rather shames the plot that we were hatching today to celebrate the 50,000th visitor to our show here that we're expecting next week. I think it just means there have to be two prizes, because
so,
clearly
too.
If we can get to a million in January, it'd be a great thing.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.